The reality for many of you is that investment properties where you live have become absolutely unaffordable. The good news is that there are many cities with affordable properties and many of those under 100K. If you're someone who's ready to buy your first out-of-state property in the next 4 months, then I encourage you to check out my free training that'll break down the process and show you exactly what it takes to invest out of state. I purchased properties out of state and it's changed my life. The same is possible for you. You simply need the right information. My free training will help you take that next step towards buying your first out-of-state property. You can watch the training right now at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode. Again, you can find it at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode.
Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second?
Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue, and the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast, episode 160. A few quick announcements before we get into this week's episode. If you haven't already, definitely take a moment to leave us a 5-star rating and review. It takes just a few seconds and it helps us out a whole lot. And if you do leave us a 5-star rating and review, send me an email. My email is in the show notes and I'll reply back with a link to a free training on finding and analyzing properties. So excited about this episode. First, I have to give a shout out to Chandra McQueen, who set this up and made this possible. I really, really appreciate it. Today's interview is with Cheryl McKissick Daniel, who is the president and CEO of McKissick. She is the fifth generation of the McKissick family's century-old business, the oldest minority and women-owned design and construction firm in the nation. Her company currently employs over 150 employees and has contracted more than $50 billion in construction over the past decade. Some of her notable projects include the new Terminal 1 at JFK International Airport, LaGuardia Central Terminal, building redevelopment, Coney Island Hospital, campus renovation, and Harlem Hospital Center modernization. She's done so many more amazing projects, and these are just a few. This episode was absolutely incredible. So without further ado, let's get into it.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. Definitely make sure you subscribe, make sure you like, share on all the platforms. Definitely appreciate it and helps us go a long way. Very excited about this interview today. First, I just have to say, Chandra and Cheryl, thank you so much for including me in your week. I know you have a busy weekend ahead and sad that the weather's not better in LA, but really appreciate you two taking the time to include me in your week. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Definitely, definitely. So Cheryl, let's jump right into it. Let the people know who you are and what you do for those who may not know what you do.
I'm Cheryl McKissick Daniel, president and CEO of McKissick & McKissick, the nation's oldest black-owned design and construction firm, incorporated in 1905, but our roots go back much further to 1790. Currently run our office in New York, Philadelphia, and various satellite offices across the country. We provide construction management, general contracting, and compliance services. And so we also are venturing into a little bit of development.
Okay.
And I assume that's why I'm here. Real estate is, you know, it's important for us to own our real estate. Mm-hmm. And so it's more of creating the project, right? Instead of working on the project.
Right.
So that's our next move. Definitely. As a company.
Definitely. Very exciting. Very exciting. So as I was doing my research, I noted that two of your relatives, I believe it was Moses McKissick III and Calvin McKissick, were the first two licensed architects in Tennessee. Is that right?
That's correct.
So can you talk to us more about that history? And you know, it seemed like it was a turning point and obviously a big accomplishment. Mm-hmm. So I'd love if we could talk about that a bit.
So in 1790, the first descendant of our family came to this country as a slave and was taught the trade of making bricks by his slave master, William McKissick. Originally, they were in North Carolina and then moved to Spring Hill, Tennessee. Just so happens, Chan and I were there this past week, and we got to see the three mansions that were actually built with my great-grandfather and my great-great-grandfather and my great-grandfather's bricks.
Wow.
So Moses McKissick the first, he was the first descendant of our family. He was taught the trade of making bricks. His son, Moses McKissick the second, was a master carpenter. And he was known for the spiral staircases and the carpentry finishes on homes in the South. And we saw it. It was just absolutely wow. amazing. These homes that were built in the 1850s, 1860s, they are still, the floors are still level.
It's crazy.
It's crazy. The walls are so thick. These homes were built to last hundreds of years, and they are lasting hundreds of years. Yeah. So Moses McKissick III is my grandfather, and he and his brother Calvin were the first black licensed architects in the country with license 117 and 118 in the state of Tennessee. They incorporated us, however, in 1905. So in 1905, there were no architectural licensing laws. Mm. You just drew your documents and then you would build them.
Right.
And so it wasn't until the 20s in Tennessee that architectural licensing laws came into effect. So now these two men that have been in business for 15 years, you know, if they didn't get their license, they were going to be out of business. Mm. And so they went to architecture school through correspondence. And then if you can imagine two black men in the South going, you know, to the courthouse to take their license, they were rejected over and over and over again. They finally found favor with one of the board members mm-hmm. who convinced the rest of the licensing board that they weren't going to pass. So they may as well let them take the exam. And so they took the exam and they passed. And of course, they didn't want to give them their license, but eventually they did. And because they became the first black licensed architects in the country, Tennessee, the licensing board, got a lot of notoriety. Mm. And so they now realize that this was, you know, a unique opportunity for them.
Right.
And so they supported my grandfather and my uncle, great uncle Calvin, to get their license in 22 other states.
Wow.
It is truly an amazing story. Like I said, we were there in Nashville, and there's a place called Pulaski, which is where the Ku Klux Klan started. Mm. And that literally is 30 minutes from Spring Hill, Tennessee.
Wow.
And my grandfather, my great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather both supplied bricks and worked on the Giles County, which is where the Ku Klux Klan started, mm-hmm. the courthouse there.
Wow.
So when you think about the fact that, you know, these black men were able to achieve what they were able to achieve back in that time with all the hostility, you know, you just begin to wonder just like how did they get it done? I know. It's a sense of strength for me when I have to go up against, you know, the hard knocks of New York City.
Yep.
I'm like, well, you know, I haven't had to deal with anything like my ancestors have had to deal with.
Yeah.
'Cause they had construction sites all over the South.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would travel by day. And, you know, they would leave for like a month and a half to go visit all of their construction sites because they couldn't travel at night. They'd have to stay at people's houses because they couldn't stay in hotels. It was just a whole totally different way of living.
Wow.
And I often say, if I did not go to my construction site for 2 months, what would happen? What would happen?
Yeah,
it's, you know, the loyalty of people and, you know, the ability to the integrity of people, I want to say, back in those days just had to be way above where we are right now, because those people would work without the owner of the company, the president, vice president coming to the job sites.
Yeah.
And they were able to build colleges and universities throughout the South. They have probably left their mark on about 19 historically black colleges.
Wow.
Yeah. Over the last 100 years.
That's huge. So,
yeah, that's huge, right?
Yeah.
Tuskegee University is one of my favorite colleges. So my grandfather built many of the buildings there. And when I first came back to Nashville to work with my mother, I would ride with her like to Tuskegee, to Memphis, all these places. But Tuskegee, we'd get there and we'd sit and we'd like, oh my God, this campus is beautiful.
Wow.
And we were renovating a dormitory that my grandfather built.
Wow.
And so it was just a sense of pride for these universities. Fisk University, the library, Carnegie Library, where the Aaron Douglas murals are painted directly on the wall.
Wow.
It's just beautiful. We saw that this weekend, and Chan got a chance to take pictures. Meharry Medical College, there are like 9-10 buildings on that campus. We built 9. Tennessee State University. I mean, the list just goes on. So it's amazing. I like to say we documented the black experience through our structures. And then if you layer in the churches, 6,000 churches.
6,000. Wow. Had to do a double take.
I know. 6,000 churches. And then the elementary schools. It's an amazing legacy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So thank you for explaining that. I really, really appreciate that. So I was doing some research and I actually had an opportunity to watch some interviews with your mother. And
I didn't get to her, did I?
No, we'll get to it. You're good. And so I know, you know, there was a period of time when she stepped in and took over the company. And in the interview I was watching, she was mentioning like she didn't really know anything about architecture or the business. And she was just documenting, you know, what she went through. So I'd love to hear from your perspective, just some of the challenges she faced and, you know, how that inspired you just watching her persevere and succeed.
Yeah. So when Moses McKissick III, my grandfather and his brother, they left the business to my father,
right,
who was William McKissick. And we used to call him a good old boy because, I mean, no, I'm serious. Because he really didn't have to do anything for contracts. You know, he didn't write proposals or anything. It was just on handshake.
Wow.
And so my mother literally, she said she only knew the telephone number to the office because she hadn't been to the office in 17 years when she was thrust into being CEO. It was probably, I think it was 4 days before my twin sister and I were graduating from Howard University. And my father had a massive stroke, and we all had to go back to Nashville. Mom was already in Washington, so we all go back to Nashville. And so at first, you know, it was really around, you know, how's our father doing?
Right.
And, you know, let's get him stabilized. And then the business piece start coming in after that when she began to realize that he's not going to be able to come back to work for a while.
Yeah.
And so she went into the office and, you know, the first thing she had to do was assess where everything was because she literally she didn't know anything. And she had a lot of opposition. You know, there were a lot of people who felt, you know, this may be your husband's business, but you're a woman. Mm-hmm. You're not an engineer. You're not an architect. So how are you going to manage this? And she was determined. She basically, I think what kept her going is she would think about the fact that she had 3 daughters. And, you know, the 3 of us were all in architecture, engineering. We were headed in the right direction. We hadn't gotten to the company yet, but we were headed in the right direction. And she took everything she had to say, I'm going to keep this company for them. Mm-hmm. And if I can just, you know, hang on long enough, then they will come in as my support. So my father had given stock options to several of his employees. They felt like they were owners. They did not own majority of the stock. My mm-hmm. mother did. So she had to deal with them around a boardroom table and their attorneys coming in, you know, trying to tell her, okay, you may be the owner, but we don't want you to be the president. We don't want you to run this company. Mm-hmm. And my mother said, I'm definitely going to run this company. And she has a master's degree in psychology. Mm-hmm. And I always say that she's able to understand the manias and the phobias of people that can't understand why a woman can run a business. And so she was determined.
Yeah.
And she did it. She was one of the best salespeople the company ever had. She sold business all the way up to Washington, D.C. And so there were several businesses. It wasn't just the architecture engineering mm-hmm. business. She had to deal with the construction business, which she didn't understand how that operated. Mm-hmm. Daddy's partner came in one day and gave her a bag full of cash. Said, this is your cut. And she's like, cut for what? And that's when she said, you know, something's not right about this business. I think I need to get rid of this. And she did.
Yeah.
He owned real estate. We owned College Hill, which were apartments right next to Tennessee State. Mm-hmm. So mom had to handle that. You know, she had to deal with the realtor and, you know, renovating and everything you have to do around an apartment.
Wow.
And then he owned Devonnell, which was another apartment complex. So she had a lot to do, and then property everywhere.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my father was a man's man. He, you know, he didn't really go home. First of all, he didn't expect anything was going to happen to him. Mm-hmm. I think if he had, he would have set things up a little better. But mom did extremely well. She was able to get a grasp on that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is extremely inspiring to me. She always felt like women were equal. She always felt black people were equal. And she just never had a problem walking into a room full of men. A room full in Nashville, all we had was white and black.
Yeah.
That's all we had.
Yeah.
Now we have a whole lot more. But my mother had no problem doing that.
Yeah.
She became like a peacock in society, if you ask me. She integrated the Swan Ball, which was the elite arts community of Nashville. Mm-hmm. And then she sued the city of Nashville over the airport when they did not let one contract to a minority. And although she sued, they blackballed her for about 5 years, but they gave a contract to another minority firm. And she thought that was a win.
Wow.
It didn't bother her really that she didn't get the work, but that mm-hmm. she opened up a door. I mean, she kicked through a door.
Definitely.
Probably 20 years after she sued the city of Nashville, the attorney that was on the other side saw mom and I out to lunch or dinner. I can't remember where it was. And he came over and he kneeled and he said, you are an amazing woman. And you were right at that time. I mean, it was.
That's deep.
It went 20 years later for, you know, her to, you know, get her flowers from this man that had, you know, gone after her extremely hard. And today she's the same person at 92. At 92, she's the same person.
Yeah.
You know, I remember my early days in New York, and I'm building, you know, I got great contracts, but I needed to build more. I needed to make that next level move. And I called mom because I'm looking at TV mm-hmm. and there's Pataki. He's our governor. And I said, mom, and I just talking, mom, if I could meet that man, I think it would change things for me and it'd be a game changer for me. So mom said, oh, I'll call you right back. And I'm like, what is she doing now? She called me back probably a day later. And she says, Cheryl, guess what? You're having lunch with Governor Pataki and the Governor Sundquist for the state of Tennessee on April whatever date. And everyone else is paying $5,000. But because you're from New York and they know who I am, they're only charging you $2,500. Wow. I'm like, I will drop everything and I'll be there.
Yeah.
I ended up flying to Nashville. And because I was the only one from New York, they sat me right next to the governor.
Wow.
And so I had Pataki next to me. I had the governor of Tennessee right across from me on a long table. And that's when I developed a good relationship with Governor Pataki. So when we got back to New York, I had a little fundraiser for him. And, you know, then he said, you know what, we should have dinner. So my husband and I show up at the 21 Club in Manhattan. I'm thinking it's a dinner with, you know, 50 people. Mm-hmm. You know, like he's inviting me to a dinner where he's going to talk to, you know, a close group of friends. I get there and the maitre d' takes my husband and I over to a table with five people. I'm like, is the governor coming? They're like, oh, yeah, he's coming with Patrick Donahue and Kathy Blaney. I said, it's just the five of us? He's like, oh, yeah. I swear to God, I start sweating from here to here because I wasn't prepared for that.
Right.
I have learned over the years that when you sit in front of a politician, you have to have an ask. You have to have something that you want to ask. And I wasn't prepared for that. And so the governor comes in and we're sitting, we're talking, we're getting to know each other. He said, how can you help me? How can I help you? And I just put up, I'm just trying to get rich here. Like, and then I just laughed because that was the honest truth. Okay. But I couldn't figure out how to change it into what I really wanted to say, which is I need more projects here. But he understood and he laughed and he said, well, New York's a great place for you to get rich. And then he, from there, introduced me to a lot of his cabinet members, and it was a game changer because we, they began to look at us as not a sub-consultant in an MWBE program, but begin to look at us as someone we could, a company they could make a prime contractor.
Right.
And that's what we did. And, you know, Republicans were different back then. Mm-hmm. Republicans were transactional, very much about the business and
right.
getting business done and business to other Republicans.
Right.
And so that is how his administration worked. And, you know, it had nothing to do with color. It had everything to do with business.
Right.
And, you know, wanting to promote a firm out of Nashville in New York because of the relationship with the governor.
Right.
It's all relationships. It always comes back to that. And so my mother did that.
Yeah.
All the way from Nashville, she took her leverage and moved the needle for me in New York.
Definitely. Shout out to mom.
Shout out to mom.
Appreciate you diving into that. So did you always know you were going to be in the business? Were you and your siblings like groomed to be in the business? What was that like for you?
Yes. I didn't know. We always knew we were going to be in construction, mm-hmm. architecture, or engineering.
Yeah.
My father used to have a saying, you can go to any school that you want to, but the only school I'm paying for is Howard University. So we always knew we were going to go to Howard, and we knew it was going to be architecture, engineering. Mm-hmm. But when I graduated from Howard, I wanted to move to New York. The only place I ever wanted to work was New York City. And I didn't really want to work for the family company because the company wasn't in New York. So I knew I wanted to go out, get experience from other large companies. And of course, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. And any company that you work for there is just the experience and what you learn from those corporations you can take anywhere. So that was my plan. And that's exactly what I did. I worked for Weilinger Associates, which is a world-renowned engineering firm. Where we designed silos for missiles. And then from there, I went to Turner Construction. And that's when I decided, you know, this is what I like. I like construction. There's no one at that time who would walk into a room and say, "Oh, you're an engineer." I never got that. I just didn't have an engineering personality, even though I loved the work. It just wasn't where I could flourish. Construction was a little different because it's more hands-on, more people, and, you know, I really enjoy people. And so motivating people, talking to people, you know, collaborating, and that's what construction is. And so that is, you know, where my heart was. And so I'm at Turner for several years, and that's when my mom called up my boss and told my boss I was quitting. Then she called me and told me, "Cheryl, you quit today. I just talked to your boss." I'm like, "Not John McGordy." John was like the type of boss you're afraid of. He actually came out of the office smiling like, "Your mother is so sweet." I'm like, "But I don't have a job." He's like, "You're going to Nashville." And that was actually, you know, when I look back on it, I wasn't happy then, but now I'm very happy. You know, parents just have that sixth sense. They know what you need to do, then the next step. And sometimes they have to step in. I actually just used this on my own daughter. My daughter, Daryl, she graduated from Georgetown, George Washington University, and moved here to L.A. And, you know, looking for jobs. She actually ended up working for an architectural firm. And then she started working for a real estate firm doing research. And then during COVID, she was laid off. And so I said, "Well, you can work for the business, you know, remotely. Nobody's in the office. Everybody's working remotely." So she's been doing that since 2020. And so now, of course, as time progresses, she wants a raise. She wants, you know, more prominence. I'm like, "Well, you can't do that in L.A. Like, how are you going to do that in L.A.? We don't, we're not operating in L.A. And so she was just loves it here. She she didn't want the weather, everything we just talked about. And I'm like, "You know what? Sometimes you have to take a sacrifice to get your professional career together, so that you can become the person and have the resources that you need so that you can move back to L.A. in the future." And so she just moved back to New York about 2 weeks ago. And she's starting, you know, in the office April 1st. So I'm excited about that. I think when she looks back on, you know, the pressure I had to apply to get her here, to get her there, I think she's going to appreciate it the same way I appreciated my mother.
Definitely. Definitely.
It's amazing. It goes full circle.
Yeah.
But you asked me about inspiration, and I thought back like, okay, my mother had to step in and make me do this. And I know what's right for my child. I need to step in and do that just the way she did.
Definitely. It's crazy how history repeats itself.
And it repeats itself. That is so true.
Definitely. So I know, as I was doing research, that you eventually purchased the company from your mother and, you know, became the leader of the company. What was that transition like? Because, of course, you know, you spent a good number of years working with her and working at the company. What was it like to be the person in charge now?
So after commuting to Nashville from New York for a couple of years, I decided I needed to go back to New York.
Yeah.
And I opened up my own company called the McKissick Group. And that's where, you know, I began to really build and understand, you know, how to build a company in a big, complicated city like New York. And then over time, probably I would say almost 10 years, my mother, her blood pressure is getting high. She's having, you know, physical issues. You know, people, the way they do business is not the way she's used to doing business. She trusts people. So I just came home. So I did to her what she did to me. I said, I said, guess what? Today is your last day at work. You are retiring.
Yeah.
Period. She's like, no, I'm not. I'm like, oh, yes, you are. We're going to move that desk right from under you. And she said when she was walking to the car that day, she was doing leprechaun kicks because she was so relieved because the pressure had gotten so great.
Yeah.
So I came in different from my mother. I already had a business. I am an engineer. I understood architecture and construction, so I could come in and interview her staff and figure out who's doing what.
Yeah.
And who needs to stay, who needs to go. But then, after I decided to keep her three offices open, the amount of work that you would get in the southern states, like her offices were in Memphis, Nashville, and Montgomery, you know, maybe they were building schools for $4 or $5 million, you know, $10 million. We build schools for $300 million in New York. Okay, so it was just a no comparison, but it's the same amount of work.
Right.
So I decided it's best to close those offices so I could spend all my time building in New York.
Right.
Which is a good thing for me because I really needed to focus. I mean, New York is fast paced. Right now, when I'm in LA, I don't know what's going on. But it's moving.
Right.
Transactions are happening.
Right.
And, you know, I'm not there. And so that's what I did. I sold everything. I mean, I closed everything. And then mom really just did consulting work for me. Which was, you know, been great. And she still helps.
Wow.
She still helps.
That's
She's
awesome.
A great help. You know, it's like, Mom, I need to see the mayor of Nashville. No problem. She can make it happen. So, however, you know, taking on the responsibility of McKissick and McKissick is a big responsibility. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as when I think about it, what keeps me going is I don't ever want it to go under during my watch.
Yeah.
I'm fifth generation, right? You know, businesses, I think it's one out of five businesses failed in the first year. So to be able to pass a company down to the second generation after the failed businesses, I think that's about, you know, 60%. And then the pass to a third generation is 20%. Mm-hmm. And passing to a fourth generation is 2%.
Wow.
And we're fifth generation and we're Black in America. So when, you know, I start thinking about the gravity of that, like, oh my God, like, this is something that, you know, first of all, we should all be proud of.
Yeah.
Because with all the problems our country has, we were still able to do this. Others have been able to do this. There's this ability to create your own destiny. And so with that in mind and thinking this is not going to happen under my, I'm not going to have things go haywire under my watch. That's when I start thinking the real thing I need to do is to get the sixth generation a part of this business. Because then that's really an anomaly. That is a unicorn. Like, where is the sixth generation business? And it's interesting now. It's all women.
Right.
And, you know, it's, I have two girls. Yeah. So what, you know, used to be run by men is now all run by women.
Right.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's what keeps me going. That keeps me inspired.
Definitely.
Yeah.
What were some challenges you faced in those early days? And what are some that you face now as a Black woman in this space?
Well, in New York City, if you look at city contracts, mm-hmm. less than 1.2 go to women of color. So, you know, the challenge is that when you have an MWBE status, mm-hmm. sometimes you're stigmatized that your staff isn't as good. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they try to say minority firms are more expensive. I have never understood that one. It's the thoughts that people have project on your business and, you know, the assumptions yeah. they have about your business, you know, that you don't have bonding, you don't have capital. I'm like, well, you don't look at my bank account.
Right.
You don't know what I have. Right. And, you know, I've actually seen some of the large companies' corporate accounts because they have idiots who mail it out by mistake. Okay.
Wow.
I've seen yes.
Oh my gosh.
One of the larger companies in New mm-hmm. York, there was an RFP out. The client asked everyone to mail in their financial statement. Mm-hmm. This guy mailed it to everybody instead of just the client. And so I'm like, well, golly, you all are smoke and mirrors, right? Like, so don't come count what I have.
Right, right.
And say what I can or can't do. Only I can do that. You know, there's always the fight of percentages. So when I first started with the MWBE program, when they first started in New York 30 years ago, mm-hmm. the percentages were probably 10% MWBEs on all city and state contracts. Now it's up to 30, 35.
Wow.
But it really ought to be 50.
Yeah.
When you look at the capacity of MWBE firms. And so we are constantly fighting that fight. The majority of our program dollars go to white women-owned businesses. and so that's another issue.
Right.
I just recently found out in Nashville that McKissick, me, I can't be counted as a woman-owned business. I can only be counted as a minority business.
Why is that?
That's the craziest statute I've ever heard of. And that's their regs. So that's what I'm saying. It's not yeah. it's not uniform. A lot of people don't know the difference between a minority-owned business, an MBE, a disadvantaged business, a DBE. A service disabled veteran business. People don't know all these terminologies and they want to clunk it all together. But it's all started around people of color.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not getting the majority of the work under those programs. So that's a challenge. I have challenges with people who come in and assume, oh, you don't really build, do you? I had a developer come to me and he wanted a joint venture. Mm-hmm. And this has happened several times. He wanted a joint venture because I knew the client, not him. This would be a new client for him. So he wanted to use our name. Then he said, but we're going to do all the work. And I'm like, well, I don't understand how that works. You know, and then basically, because I've seen it before, I just told him, listen, this isn't a good fit, and walked away from that. But that still happens.
Yeah.
Still happens. We had the casinos come into New York City. I got with my political consultants and attorneys, and I drew up, you know, what an engagement with McKissick would look like with the developers. And we asked for a small percentage, and 40% of the construction, stuff like that.
Yeah.
They, you know, they have you in, they want to, you know, impress you because they know they need you on the team. But then when you give them that piece of paper, they're like, I think we're going in another direction.
Right.
So they don't even want to negotiate about it. And so, you know, it's still trying to open up doors. I'm sure you've heard about Affirmation Tower.
Yeah, that's going to be my next question.
Yeah. I mean, again, that's prime property in Hudson Yards, next to the convention center, Midtown Manhattan. There's never been a skyscraper built by people of color. And here we are. We had the best team to do it. We have the best architect, the best plan. And, you know, we're being stopped. And, you know, you can only think to yourself, it's got to be greater powers out there that are doing this. Because if you look at what New York City wants, because we took a poll, New York City wants to see Affirmation Tower. New York City loves the statement that we're making, that business, real estate business and ownership is what we need to, you know, correct the wrongs. We're going to get there faster if we own our properties. And that's why I love what you're doing here.
Thank you.
Because we have to own what we do. And it creates an ecosystem because, I mean, if you look at my company and you look at my senior managers, they look like me. They're women, they're black males. And, you know, I don't have to do a blind interview to hire black people, right?
Right.
I could talk to my counterparts and they're like, well, you know, we did a blind interview this year. So we took off all the names and all the addresses of all the applicants who were applying to be interns at our company for the summer. And we got more people of color than we ever had. Because if the name was on there, and if the address was on there, it'd be easy to deduce that they are of color. And I said, well, we don't have to do that at McKissick because we treat everybody the same. We have the United Nations. And everybody's good.
Yeah.
Everybody's good.
Definitely.
So Affirmation Tower, you know, we're in a little bit of a battle. I think that if we can't get it done under the governor, we'll get it done through our mayor.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting to me. I mean, like, our leadership in New York, we have a female governor, but then right under her, we have a black leader of the Senate, a black leader of the House of Representatives, of the Assembly, and then right on down the line. I mean, it's like you go like 10 or 12 more people and they're all people of color.
Right.
And then we have it in the city. So why can't we do Affirmation Tower?
Doesn't make sense to me.
Right. And it has nothing to do with Democrats or Republicans because they both have very serious issues. It has to do with economics. And open up the doors for people like us to become, you know, equal when it comes to economics. But there's a fear there, or it's either fear or greed, right? It's got to be one or the other.
Definitely.
And it's probably both. So anyway, we just keep pushing, you know, my friend Don, he developed one building downtown and that's probably the only building developed by a black person, beautiful, residential condo. And so we need more of that.
Right.
We need more of that. It shouldn't have to be in Harlem.
I agree.
Yeah.
Definitely agree. Can you tell, for those who may not be familiar with Affirmation Tower, can you just share like the project and the team and just what the vision is for it?
Sure. Affirmation Tower will be the second tallest building in Manhattan, just slightly below Freedom Tower, because we didn't want to trump Freedom Tower. Designed by the world-renowned David Adjaye. He is a Nigerian, British architect. I want to get it right. Because I called him African-American. He's like, no, I'm not African-American. And he's not. His architecture is beautiful. It will hold the NAACP's national headquarters, New York headquarters. We're hoping to get Al Sharpton's museum, national museum there. There'll be office building, hotels. I think it's two hotels, one luxury hotel and a micro hotel, and a huge skating ring at the top. It will be an icon and beacon for all the world to see. It would be a tourist attraction. And it would have been built by us.
Right.
And that's what we want to see.
Definitely. Is there anything we can do to support? Like, can we write letters to the governor? Like, what's the status of it now? Are you just kind of waiting for the RFP to be looked at again?
So the RFP was out. We proposed. We did a presentation. And then December of 2021, it was she ended the RFP. Well, she didn't. What's it called? ESD. Rescinded the RFP because they said they wanted to have affordable housing. This is not a location for housing.
Right.
There's no train. There's no, you know, retail. It's not a lot in that area. It's a huge convention center.
Right.
So we're waiting for that to happen. We're waiting for the RFP to come out. And we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Awesome. Awesome. Can we talk about... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, as far as help, it's really getting the word out.
Yeah.
You know, we just want to do a groundswell. Like Black Lives Matter, how that movement just grew. We need to do the same thing about Black economics. We need to do the same thing. We need to hold our politicians accountable, all of our leaders, religious leaders, everything. We need to hold everyone accountable on that and not let it go.
Definitely.
Not till things change.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, it will definitely be a monumental project, and I'm really hoping and believing that it'll go through, and you know, maybe we'll come back again and talk about what you all were able to do. So I'm excited and looking forward to seeing it come to life.
Me too. It's gonna happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I heard it here. Cheryl, I also wanted to talk about the JFK project, Terminal
okay.
One. Can you share some more about that?
Sure.
Yeah,
we have been blessed to work on some of the most iconic projects in New York City, and JFK is definitely one of them. So JFK Terminal One is probably the first public-private partnership project that New York City through the Port Authority is doing. And it started off with Carlyle Group, Magic Johnson Enterprises, and Loop Capital. Loop is an investment bank, a Black investment banking company out of Chicago and New York. And so what they are doing is demolishing the existing Terminal One and building a new state-of-the-art terminal, which is going to cost about, the whole project's about $9.5 billion.
Wow.
It's the largest airport project happening in the country. And so you know, this goes back to what happens when we're owners. Magic Johnson and Loop Capital, Jim Reynolds, who's the president of Loop Capital, they said, Cheryl, we want you a part of this project because we know if we get you in as project manager, we can count on you to make sure that we have MWBE through this entire project. And that's exactly how it happened. And so we are the program managers for that project. We have responsibility to oversee design, construction, and the MWBE program, which is massive if you think about $9.5 billion.
Yeah.
We have been working on this project for 3.5 years, and it just got started in May.
Wow.
Just red tape, mm-hmm. you know, dealing with state, city, and local agencies in New York. It's overwhelming, to say the least. You know, there were periods of time that we didn't think that this project was going to go ahead. In that process of the 3 years to get it to the point where, you know, we could go to closing and actually have all the funding in place to complete the project, Carlyle decided to sell their ownership to a Spanish company called Ferrovial. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of changed the flavor of things. But Carlyle still owns a portion of the project, but Ferrovial owns the majority of the project. But it's moving ahead.
Yeah.
You know, it took deep pockets.
It sounds like
deep pockets to get that going.
Yeah.
You know, other projects of ours are LaGuardia Airport Central Terminal. We did the entire MWBE program there. That was probably $4.5 billion. Next to it is the Delta Terminal, which is even larger. So we're actually providing construction management services for Delta.
Wow.
And now we're working with Delta out at JFK Terminal 4. We are the independent engineer for the MTA, and that is the transit system for the city of New York. It's the largest transit system in the Western Hemisphere. We oversee their capital program, and we've been doing that for 14 years.
Wow.
And so that capital program right now is $54 billion for a 5-year period. So it's a lot of work, a lot of capital work. I mean, under it, they're doing East Side Access, which is, you know, access from Manhattan to Queens, the 7th Avenue extension, the 2nd Avenue subway, because, you know, 2nd Avenue, they extended the subway north.
Wow.
And now they're going to, I think it's up to 96th Street. Now they're looking to extend it up to Harlem, which, you know, south, because you're from New York, 2nd Avenue really needed that type of transportation.
Definitely.
Let's see. We're finishing up right now a $1 billion hospital in Coney Island, called Coney Island Hospital. We've done Harlem Hospital, which was beautiful. Harlem Hospital was amazing because we took the murals, mm-hmm. And they're now on the outside of the building. It's an amazing project. Manhattanville, Columbia, Manhattanville. That was a $10 billion program over 10 years. And these projects, you know, we used to just call them mega projects, but now they're ultra mega projects. We're pursuing the tunnel between New York and New Jersey.
Wow.
That's about anywhere between 16 and 20 billion. The RFP is calling for 300 people from a consultant for 18 years. So we've teamed with two international firms. And so we have a 50-50 shot there because there are only two teams out there. And so we're pursuing that project. And I tell everyone, that's my swan song. When I'm handing this baton over.
Yeah.
Yes. Very exciting. That project should have been completed. Mm-hmm. Christy stopped that tunnel probably 10 years ago, and it would have been in place by now. But it's critical infrastructure. I mean, like, the tunnel is crumbling. And so, you know, if we don't handle that soon, I'm afraid New York and New Jersey won't be connected through a tunnel.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome.
So we work for the FTA, the RFA, FRA, and that's national work. Our work extends out here to San Francisco, in the Bay Area, where we do oversight of the transit system, Chicago, New Orleans. So we are busy. The most exciting news, though, is we are getting ready to reestablish our office in Nashville.
Okay.
So we are going back to our roots. And it's a good thing because they're building the Tennessee Titans new stadium there. So we're working to get on that because we built Eagle Stadium. We were part of building the original Titans stadium. So Nashville is important to us. And then we're looking to open, we have opened an office in Orlando, Central Florida. Yeah. Orlando, Tampa, and St. Pete's would pretty much be our geographical area. So we are busy.
It definitely sounds like it.
We are busy.
Definitely. Thanks
exciting. It's exciting.
Definitely. One of the things I looked into was Legacy Engineers, which I think is an amazing organization and program that you have going on. Can you share a bit more about that?
Sure. And again, you know, it's ownership and, you know, how to effectively create ownership in the Black community. And so a friend of mine, John Rice, who John was a managing partner at AKF, which is a well-known, prominent mechanical, electrical, plumbing, and fire protection design firm in New York. When he retired, he wrote this whole plan to start a company called Legacy, where we would come together and bring young engineers in, teach them to be owners, and then turn the business over to them. So John and I opened up Legacy in 2019, at the end of 2019. So we were going into COVID. But because there are just not a lot of mechanical, electrical, plumbing, and fire protection design, MBE firms, we got busy quick. People, you know, other firms had to meet their MBE goals. John was well known. We do good work. And then our story. They love our story. And so now we have about 15 engineers in place. We have an outside consultant who's worked with them on ownership and how to be an owner. And, you know, there's a lot to that. People don't understand, you know, you come in, you can work a craft for a business for 30, 40 years and never understand how to run the business. Yep. And so simple stuff, just reading a financial statement is important. Being able to do financial projections, understanding, you know, what clients, you know, you need to cultivate for 5 years down the line, not for next year, for 5 years down the line. What's going to, you know, keep this business growing and operating. And so it's been great. It's been great. We're excited about it. We haven't turned over any ownership yet. Because, you know, I said, well, you know, we need to build up the value of the company, and then it's worth something to turn over, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're in the process of that. So I think we'll be there in the next few years. But there are a couple of engineers in our business that we will probably be bringing in as owners in the next year or so.
That's awesome.
And you didn't hear it here.
Definitely. So when you think about the future of like the construction industry, what do you see? And then, you know, how can, you know, the next generation be a part of it? And, you know, Black people, women, like how can everyone be a part of it?
So I think like any other business, you know, IT is going to play a big role. When you think about construction, it's a big data problem. Mm-hmm. You know, like you got architectural documents, you got all the punch lists, you know, all the contractors and all the contracts and permits and things like that. It's a big data issue, and we have not done a good job as an industry building a platform to deal with all of that. But I think that's where we're headed. You know, the 3D printing, mm-hmm. Modular, I think all of that is going to impact our business tremendously, especially outside of places like New York and LA, where, you know, everything, when you build in New York or in a very urban city like LA, mm-hmm. everything's unique. But when you get outside of that and you want to build a hospital, a school, a jail, or whatever, an office building, it can be, you know, typical floors. And you can build those typical floors anywhere and bring them together and like a kit of parts and put it all together. So I think that's going to have an effect on our business. I think over time, it's possible that architects and contractors are going to come together under one roof. That's going to be a big fight. But, you know, it creates an efficiency for the clients. And so, you know, maybe architects start becoming contractors and contractors start becoming architects, you know, that, and it becomes one house.
Yeah,
I could see that happening. Because we're already, our mode of delivery for construction projects is design build. And that means the contractor contracts with the designer, the architect, and the engineer, and then builds. So we're already setting up, you know, the platform and stage for something like that to happen. You know, in talking to young people, it's vast. It's just so many areas that you can go into. When people think about construction, it's not construction boots and actually out on the site, you know, hammering nails and pouring concrete. No, there's the financial end, there's the business development end, there's marketing, there's PR, there's writing that has to, you know, for the proposals, business development. There's insurance. So, I mean, there's every facet of business that you would have with any other corporation that, you know, creates a construction company. So, you know, I feel as though you could be an architect, an engineer, you could have a communications degree, you could have a business degree, what have you. My daughter has a degree in organizational science. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's perfect. That's perfect for running a business. It's not necessary to have a degree in architecture and engineering to be in our field.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this has just been an amazing interview. I'm just sitting back, soaking up all this great information, and you know, I really appreciate you diving into different aspects of the history of the business, the history of the family, your journey, and you know, it's very inspirational. It's very inspirational to see that 100 years later, you know, you're still carrying the baton, and mm-hmm. you know, Your daughter's coming behind you to carry it for 230 years later. Excuse me, I had to double it. I had to double it. 230 years later, you're still going. So, I appreciate you taking this time, and if you could just let everybody know how they can, where they can find you, how they can support what you have going on, and keep up with you.
So I'm on Instagram, and I am Cheryl McKissick. That's CHERYLMCKISSACK, and Facebook.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And thank you to everyone for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you like. Make sure you share this with a friend. Share this with somebody you love, somebody you care about. This was an amazing episode. You made it to the end. So thank you all. Talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue and on Twitter at Bread Podcast. That's B-R-E-D Podcast. Until next time.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.